Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
I'm going to read another draft of this research paper, a hands-on IoT training device, and I've been building it, and what's happened is it's taken a little while for the next crop of devices to come in from China, and that's the thing. You build a series of prototypes, and as you build one thing, it goes to a certain area and you understand that you have to advance and build it. And in the time that things have been ordered, you say, well, I'll work on it now, but up to a certain point, then I'll have a wait for when things have to come in from overseas. In that time, you write up the research paper. Now, the audience here, good friend Michael, perhaps Pino, will listen through to it. And unfortunately, I suppose for the 80 or 100 odd listeners overseas, you think, oh my God, this is the, you know, I'll skip this. This is the 10th time going through it. And it's a little bit of a introduction, a taster of what it can be like to write research papers. So the really great people, they just stream them off. I don't necessarily think they're all that great, some of the research papers coming through, and they're not necessarily dealing with new things. They're in a vein of research, and so they've got the laboratories, the results coming through on a predictable time, and they can write them really quickly. Other times it takes a lot of efforts to go over and over it again, particularly when you're writing a thesis for the first time, or if you're in a new area. And this is definitely true for this. This is in a new territory. Now, one of the things I want to do before getting into this is sort of talk about sort of the experience, as I've discussed with the people. There's sort of a bit of stroke and memory things, and you write things out, and you do have mistakes in what you write out, and there's mistakes. Not so much in wiring, because the wiring sort of self corrects itself, and it's now so easy nowadays. It's, you know, you connect something to port, I don't know, 58 or rather than 54 or something like that. Something very similar, but it corrects itself very easy. So not unlike, it's a little bit different from, say, having a conversation with someone where you can forget to say a key piece of information. It's difficult. What happens here is if you get to do something in the circuit, it doesn't work. It's fairly easy to diagnose what's going on. So there's sort of the memory isn't there. Now, we've got this paradox that, look, I should be knocked out, yet I am actually truffing, slowly getting to new areas, and sort of like the new area is the realizing the new electronics which is available, realizing some long-held problems and just working away at them, and them coming together over a very long period of time. If you walked in, you'd say, oh, this crazy guy, he's concerned about how quantum mechanics doesn't work, and he's building this, and they don't link together, and he's all over the place. But as this paper comes together, you can see there's a fundamental flaw. It's not just my problem, it's a big social problem that that people have this dumb way of teaching quantum mechanics, and the end result of that is that they lock themselves out of explaining or bringing forth the value of our knowledge and technology to our kids. They wind up telling them something which is not true, not helpful, and leaving it for them. Now, you're probably hearing a huge wind at the moment. It's not there for the moment. It is a ferocious wind, and we have these tall trees around us. We tend to have the something called turpentine trees, and so the turpentines are very good in the wind. They rarely fall over. They've got large tap roots, whereas your gum trees, that they do fall over in the wind, and it's one of the things. So there's a ferocious front coming in from Antarctica, and just, I don't know, 30 kilometres up the road. It's incredible. 2 inches, apparently 2 inches of snow, and the roads are closed, and it is incredibly freezy, but you get this sort of noise around it. But talking about snow what looks it's stupid and it's stroke and stuff like that, I thought I'd tell a little bit of a story to start off with, just to try and get a glimpse into it. There's sort of one, I suppose, series of stories I could tell us, like having the strokes and stuff like that. It's been a bit like being on the bottom of the sea in a submarine, and you're there, and you can just, all you can do to communicate with other bits of your brain is just bang the pipes and hear, and occasionally you'll hear the thing, there'll be a gap, and then another part of your brain will bang the pipes back, and there's this slow thing. It's I suppose instructive. It's like having a huge reset button set, and you do your system upgrade. You basically have the BIOS, your brain BIOS, come along and open up various things. However, it gives you a new perspective on your own internal workings. And then coming along, you look at, you know, how you're working at the moment, and I think the best way I can describe it is, imagine that there is this fertile, in high up in the Himalayas, there's this, Himalayas, hard to imagine what they are, a fertile valley with villages and village mares and a stream going through it with, you know, windmills, yeah, not windmills, water mills, and donkeys, and, you know, carts carrying big loads of thatches, things around, and farm labourers in the fertile fields, and you can go up through the woods a little bit. You know, there's sometimes bears and wilds in the woods, and then up higher again above the snow line. And of course, depending just who you are, you have a little bit of time in the fields, and you start to wander in the woods, and you start to go up above the snow line and wander around and look at the different tracks there, and you climb these lonely peaks, and you look out, and you look out over the entire valley, and you look up into the sky and the cosmos, and it's a much bigger place for it. And you come back, and I'm referring to myself at the moment, you come back into the village, and people say, "Oh, where were you? You haven't been in the field. You know, lunch is ready, and all this type of stuff." And you go to say, "Oh, look, I've been up above the snow line, and there's some great views there." And then people slam the pub goes quiet, the little tavern goes quiet, and they say, "No one goes above the snow line. No one knows what's there. That's in the unknown. You can't go there." And so by and by, you sort of in you think you're in battle, but no, you have a sort of ploughing accident, and you know, a plough goes through your foot or something like that. You're out from the ploughing. You're wandering out, and you start to go up again above the snow line. But this time, because of the accident, there's certain parts that are unfamiliar. You sort of get lost and stuff like that, but there's still these great views out there. So if you can find your way to it, there's these great views. So this is Armageddon at the moment, the wind blowing, incredible. Surprise. There's part of our roof which we're going to have to nail down. Hopefully it won't rip off now. Okay, so you're up there, and some of the paths, you know, normally you take 30 seconds to split from here to here. You get a bit lost, you know, a bit disoriented. Was this the rock, or was this another rock? And still the skills are there that you look at, explore different rocks and different paths, and the path that you used to go across that scale of cliff and get up here, you can't do anymore, and you, you find a slow little goat track up there, and things seem familiar but not familiar, and you work out, why was I working here and stuff, and you still get these big vistas coming along. And but A, you can't relate to the people in the village there, and B, you can't even relate it to yourself because you're focusing on that short term movement. And I suppose the story is that, yeah, by any measure, that if you looked at that at the person trying to negotiate from one side of a field to the other in the village, yeah, that would be awful. Get rid of them. And it's pretty much the same thing, negotiating the thing high up above the snow line, working out what to do. There's no pet villages there because no one's supposed to be above the snow line. It still takes a long time. And so you wind up taking an unacceptable amount of time to move from point A to point B. But the difference is that no one else is trying to do it. Like, you're bad, you're the worst, but you're also the best because no one else is up above the snow line. And when I talk about up above the snow line, I'm referring to quantum mechanics and I suppose a bit complex algebra and a bit of computing and you know, a bit of electronics and stuff like that. And you look at it and you say, oh, like I tried to look at probability theory again, and I just did my head in. So you get that tough, and also, like, if you are suddenly got a club foot, you know, foot or whatever it is, it's quite exhausting. So before you'd go up to the snow line, go around, do a bit of business thing, and you're back in, and you say, oh, got this. Anyone interested in some snow? No, they're not interested in snow or whatever it is. But you've gone up there. Now it sort of takes a bit longer, and you get a different vista. And the fact is that no one else is doing it. In relevance to this, it's taken a while to actually connect sort of the goat track up there, which is the utility box, this physical box, with some of the experiences down in the city, and then this overall vision to say that, look, this city doesn't know about the snow, above the snow line. They don't know this, and it's still in this slow going back and forth and fixing it and stuff like that. And it's taking a long time, and things are coming together very, very slowly. And your first track up seems to be going nowhere. It just seems to be, you know, people looking at it and you're saying, that person's going to that pile of rocks over there, and then they're stumbling up to that pile of rocks over there, and well, they could have gone straight there, but it's if you can only see so far or go so far, you have to navigate amongst the piles of rocks that you can access and go across. It's only when you can come back of it, you say, oh, look, so what's the beginning thing is I'm seeing degrees of a bit of project management coming back in, Gantt charts, so that, you know, while I'm doing that, I could be doing something else which is useful. It's the fundamental thing of multitasking, it would be Gantt charting. I'm trying to think something else. The prototype cycle, which you do when you're not doing an assigned task. So would you mow the lawn? Well, you don't try and mow the lawn one way and then another. Well, you might if you're me. You try that thing. You do and build it up. And you know what exactly? So you wind up. You look back and you say, "Oh, she was. I must. I'm doing natural prototyping, or I'm actually got a system of prototypes. In this case, I've got three fairly similar prototypes: a dancing duck, Einstein to Haas, and this, they've all got a similar footprint, similar thing." So this is sort of parallel prototyping, which you would tend to do in a research laboratory. You'd say, okay, we've got these projects going, at what projects can we go to use the same resources, the same footprints, the same know-how, so they can cross-fertilise and can move resources in between. So when one project's going slow, you can put it into the other and stuff like that. And then also the sort of matrix depth of doing it in terms of here's a device that goes in a spectrum analyzer, something like that. Well, you put it in the spectrum analyzer, you do it, and then you start to run through a few things, and then you do the spectrum analyzer, run it through, and then you start to tease out the fact, you know, how people are using the spectrum analyzer. And so this sort of goes similar here. This sort of depth process here is that the utility box. How do people use it? You know, how do they use the utility box? But what are they trying to do in general? Is there a feature that this would expose and change things? So there's that depth. All of which isn't in your classic project management. The classic project management is, I'm building a bridge, I'm building a house. I've said I can do it this way. And because I've been able to tell people exactly what I'm going to do and how I'm going to do it, I can cost it. And propose it as a proposal. And this is the entire modern sort of information-based advance. So this is the Dutch and the companies. They'd say, look, we're going to South Indonesia. We're going to pick up spices. It's going to cost this much, and you'll get that much. So if you give us this much money, I can afford to... spend a little bit of it paying interest and then come back. And it's this entire idea of being able to specify. People have to specify what they want so they can do a commercial transaction. Of course, the result here is not a commodity, an item. It's a methodology. How do you do it? So it's a little bit different, and it's the R&D cycle that people are not really, really used to. Okay, that being said, I'll hope that's been useful, and it'll make this going across. So I've got my pen, and of course it's so cold here the ink doesn't flow. Look at that. Oh, it does. It's just my writing scratchy as well. Okay, just reading it through, and hopefully I've eliminated or removed too many, the word stumbling points. It's sort of like walking and walking along. And that I suppose the very interesting thing is for me is that a trained person, they just say walk across the room, oh yeah, you've got a stroke. they can see anything, or they just listen to a couple of sentences, oh yeah, I know what's going on. It is an amazing situation. Okay, hands on IoT training device. It is very windy here and very cold. Peter Collin Hill, Glenbrook, New South Wales, Australia. Abstract. A Wi-Fi battery-powered sensor module for student use is described. Diverse sensors simultaneously stream data. This supports active discovery of the connection between experimental variables. Yep, okay. The functions of a commercial device that this model emulates examined and teaching strategies proffered. Introduction. We are currently developing a small transparent suitcase containing 14 sensors to provide students with a hands-on introductory experience. I think it's getting up to 20 sensors. This box of electronics streams data to the internet, but unlike a person-centered device, there is no keyboard or screen. There are no keyboard or screen. There's no keyboard or screen. It's an example of a thing that is connected to the internet rather than a user connection. It's like if you say user, it doesn't. A user. Operated device. Device. So you can't connect a connection, can you? Okay, I can't read that. The situation where there are lots of things sending data and receiving instructions has been dubbed the Internet of Things and has attracted the three-letter acronym, TLA, of IoT. When developed, students will lift the lid of the utility box, UB, to find live sensors continuously outputting to a website that are okay. Scanning a QR code on the box will open the linked site. Typically, the first question asked is, what's in the box? It is the subsequent questions that tease out a deeper understanding. This article aims to provide a resource for teachers to read over and perhaps check back on when answering those in-depth questions. What the utility box does, heading. Okay, I'm just making it ever so simple. Like, I could say, yeah, there's more technical ways of doing that, but that's something that a teacher would understand. The UB is a working model that is 5 times larger in each linear dimension than the sensor to cloud station you might expect to currently buy in a factory or home. So obviously, Michael, you had difficulty with that, and I just have to reverse the sense of it. So it's a working model of a sensor to the cloud thing that you would have at a factory at home, except it's 5 times the larger. So can you hear the horrendous wind? I don't know if you can actually listen through all this, mate. The UB takes up 125 times the volume. Oh crap, it's really windy and cold here. Online offerings of offerings that can be purchased online. Okay, let's see if I got that one. Horrible writing, freezing cold. Unlike the real thing, a student can pull out sensors and put them into their experiments as they build them. They can explore systems by watching multiple variables change together. The ultimate aim is to instill confidence in the understanding and use of the real thing. Offering a comparative abundance of temperature, mass and pH sensors ready to go in the construction of an experiment may make some concepts more accessible, robust and less contrived. Yeah, that's the fundamental aspect of it. So, to build it, yeah, okay. An example of a classic experiment reconfigured to access more concepts is acid-base neutralization. The student first speculates about which variables might or might not be important and then places sensors to see some show little or no effect, while others, as might be expected, vary together. The experiment is run to see what happens. The amount of acid added will be measured as an increase. Mass of the mixture being measured by, there you go, the pH may have a rapid rise at first, plateau, then increase again. This behavior is the behavior of a buffer commonly found in systems that need to maintain a pH balance. In variable conditions like your skin, stomach, or reference solutions used to calibrate pH meters. Currently, with a more sparse implementation, such phenomena are rarely touched upon. The simple addition of another latest and greatest equipment offering may have limited impact. Having an insightful teacher guide will dramatically improve the student's confidence and depth of understanding, for sure. I think it's surprising I've got so many corrections still in there. But it's one of these things. You know, some people are just really good at this. To see how the UB compares to a commercial sensor, is more accurate, commercial sensor module, we'll get to know the inside of the latter. Stopping here, it's the wind's blowing me around. Doing so provides a clear reference points to compare with the US UB, but also to assess the latest technology that will have emerged since the writing of this article. What a real-world utility box looks like. Okay. For real is an informal or colloquial way of describing the real-world thing to which the model corresponds. It might be a toy car rolling down a ramp, unlike a real-world car for which we can assume most people have detailed knowledge and hence requires no explanation. IoT-enabled sensors are less familiar. We'll step through the many layers of ideas behind both the UB and its real-world counterpart. In 2016, a US electronics manufacturer, Texas Instruments, released the CC2650 sensor tag, humidity, ambient and non-contact temperatures, microphone light, pressure, 9-axis accelerometer. Values measured by the instruments on board the sensor tag are streamed in real time to the user's website. The sensor tag is powered by a button cell battery, 1 year's lifetime, and comes in a 14x50x67mm package. The term tag refers to a smallish box of electronics that can communicate information. Many people have an e-tag fitted in their cars to pay tolls. Yeah, a tile is the name of a device with a smaller footprint. For a device, typically 3x24x24mm, so you can see the difference there. You might have a Bluetooth locator on your keys to find them using an app on your mobile phone. Texas Instruments describe their sensor tags in the hands of a customer who's just unboxed it. To connect to the cloud with Bluetooth low energy, you get your sensor data online in 3 minutes. Now it says connect to it. In the context of communication with an education audience, some who of whom are not technical, will unpack some of the technology and associated terminology. Yeah, okay. How sensors produce digital outputs. Sensors are purpose-built machines that respond to some physical properties, temperature, humidity, pressure, sound, etc. This response can be measured or using less formal language, same. For a bulb thermometer, the temperatures can be read by looking at the level of mercury against a scale. Strictly speaking, you measure the thermometer's response and infer the temperature. To measure humidity, 2 thermometers are read, one with a dry bulb, the other with a wet one wrapped in moist cloth. In dry conditions, the wet one is cooled by evaporation. Referring to a conversion table allows the humidity to be inferred from the differences in wet-dry bulb temperature. No difference means 100% humidity. If it was 100% humidity and 38 degrees C, you'd find this uncomfortable, as perspiration would not cool you down. Yeah, I'm not going to unpack that even more. You're with your body temperature of 36 point blah, blah, blah. In an electronic sensor, the physical property that is to be measured impacts the condition of an electrical component that then varies the current or potential difference across, in formal language, voltage, this component in a circuit. For sensing temperature, a temperature-dependent... I'll put a comma there. Resistor might be used. Alternatively, using the phenomena of electrons moving to the cooler end of a wire, a temperature-sensitive battery called a thermocouple can produce a voltage related to the temperature. The size of the response depends on the condition, so measuring the size is approximately for the condition, and such a measurement is called analog. For instance, 0 degrees C may generate 0 volts, 50 degrees 0.3 volts, 100 degrees 6 volts on the output wire that tells us, or signals in the case if I said that, in this case temperature, yeah, I'm just going to get rid of all signals. This output wire is known as signal wire, a signal for which the size tells us how much is called an analog signal. Traditional characteristics of different types of temperature sensors. The current UB has 5 thermocouples and 5 thermistors. Beautifully put. Okay, several steps have to be added before the sensor spits out a string of zeros and ones that communicates the size of the signal digitally. A sensor that puts out a digital signal, low or high voltage levels or levels of light, voltage levels or light levels, for an optical fiber. It's called a digital sensor, e.g. a digital thermometer. The signal does not output directly numbers 0, 1, but measurable outputs are then interpreted as numbers. 0 is for 0 volts, while 1 is 3.3 volts or 5 volts, depending on the type of material used to make up the electronics. The conversion of analog signals to a digital signal is called A to D, and it's performed by an A to D chip. The precision of the chip is described by a number of bits. A 1-bit A to D converting an analog signal of 0.635 in the range of 0 to 1 volts would read 1, telling you that your signal is somewhere between the range of 0.5 and 1 volts. The temperature sensor chips used in the UB is 12-bit, or one part in 4096. That's more or less typical. And this is more or less typical. Every chip has a unique factory set 64-bit serial identification number. So every sensor not only gives a temperature, these sensors, not only, you can imagine this, you know, these people just trot through these publications, especially, the articles, the science articles from the 50s and 60s were brilliant. There was no ambiguity. Nowadays, it is so hard to go through. This is just consuming articles. Not only gives the temperature, but who is sending it. A sinister side may be that if you are given a hairdryer, for example, consider the year 2025, you might know it is connected to the cloud, giving the sensor serial number and IP address. You may need to move somewhere else, and you could be located when you dry your hair. I think I've got a double space in there. The information above paragraph is perhaps too complex to communicate immediately to a student audience. Scaffold. So scaffolding is the word, may need to be scaffolded for a student audience. The following story is an allegory of how a digital sensor works. Gee, this is so much. I've still got so much. The Night Kittens of Umbulu. The Grand Hotel is a splendid old building that stands at the banks of the Umbulu River. The river runs through the mighty Umbulu rainforest. The rainforest is home to the precious Umbulu Light Kitten. The kittens are very timid and only trust the Umbulu native tribe's people. So this is just following stock standard Childress writing, where there's a series of connected statements, so they can, it's like stepping stones. One day, Renato, the youngest child of family 13, heard a purring sound from deep in the jungle. When she was back home that evening with her family, she imitated the sound she had heard, and to her surprise, a night kitten came into the hut and purred with her. So really, I'm just following some small kids' writing, and then departed from it pretty quickly. Before long, news spread to the other villages in the Umbulu rainforest, and the children who could purr in just the right way, sometimes after hours of practice, began to have... I'll just put another comma in there. Began to have night kittens visit them. There was great joy and much talk of this wonderful happening. As the tribespeople met along the tracks and in the meadows, they would describe the wondrous events. Unabato purred, her father said proudly, and a little night kitten came and purred and slept on her lap. That's strange, our kitten was only the size of a mouse. That's strange, ours was so big it could hardly fit through the door. Let's go to the Grand Hotel by the river and get to the bottom of this. There were 10 tables in the grand ballroom of the hotel. On each table sat a kitten tamer from each village, while opposite them sat a ranger from Save the Kittens International. They were going to find out the size of all 10 Umbulu kittens and send the information down the river. River transport was very slow in those days, and there were many rapids and sudden waterfalls. Instead, they were going to use the Umbulu drums that could be heard for miles and then relayed. But they had to have a plan to report the size of each kitten, the size of each kitten the children had tamed. So this is what happened. On table number one, the ranger had piles of pocket chips that double for each stack. 1, 2, 4, 16, 32, 64. There's a space there. Remove. The plan was to push a large pile forward, and if the child smiled, the kitten was larger than 128 poker chips. Okay, so again, from teaching, this is large. You know, it's just not making the data not... It's that one grade down from ultra-explicit. If they frowned, the ranger would pull back the pile and push the 64 pile forward. It turned out that table one's kitten was the size of 31 poker chips. So the arrangement was 1, 2, 4, 8, 16 up, and 3, 32, 64, 128 back. Or using the up down number code, blah blah blah. They didn't just ask the kitten chamber as they had. To make it into a drum beat. Initially, the ranger tapped with their feet. That was too quiet. Then tapping the table. That was too quiet. Finally, they used small gongs. That did the trick. A gong for one and tapping the gong hammer on the table for zero. Okay, hopefully that's covered that thing. There's one more thing to do. Is to make sure they knew what table was reporting, so the drum outside the hotel could strike the number of times equal to the table and wait for the ranger to report, and then they would relay it up the river. Here's how the drums sounded differently for the ones and zeros. A loud boom for one, a soft tap for zero. The drum outside the hotel went boom, 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 tap, 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 tap. They listened at her back. gong, 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 tap, 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 gong. And that's 7 plus 128, 135 poker chips. That's a big kitten. Are you sure? Boom, 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 tap, 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 tap. Gong, gong, gong. Tap, 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 gong. Let's try the, try table 6, etc. Listen. That's tap, gong, tap, 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 gong, oh, sorry, whatever it is. Only 2. Finally, the information came and was sent down the Umbaloo River, and this is what the Umbaloo Herald received to publish. And so there's a thing here, and it's essentially an authentic artifact for the kids to manipulate, perhaps to do homework with. So you could do this and send for a small class, you know, to see if you can do that for homework and peer tutoring and you know, collaborative, you know, one person knows it. So you've got to, with these tasks, put them up such that, say, a third of the class can do it, and then they can tutor the other kids and stuff like that. Successful communication to students require collaboration of disciplines, sometimes referred to as a transdisciplinary approach. While teachers may pass over opportunities to bring in their ETAG and IoT products because... Oh, sorry. The concepts are overly technical. Engineers avoid imprecise language. You know, so you're left between the two things. Some of the terms and how things are explained reflect expert user origins. Cameras, printers, peripherals will often have a Twain file directory. Twain means toolbox without an interesting name, while URL means universal resource locator. So this is saying that the jargon's there, but it is really in-house jargon. The initial feedback from engineers is the tension between Nightgins and poker chips. There's no foolproof program formula for this, for what will be successful in education. There are examples of odd mixes: Gingerbread House, Samurai Pizza Cats, Sailor Moon, Miraculous Cat, Miraculous Ladybug, or the 1970s cars that drive from space to form a robot in the original Voltron. While there is no formula, you will be told by a student audience if a particular combination is credible. So, you know, really you've got to try it with the student audience. Here, poker chips could suggest some sort of social danger or element of crisis just out of focus. So it's the wrong thing. So you can see it in books. The selection of the name utility box... Gosh, sorry. Huh. Pays homage to the utility belt worn by the fictional comic book hero Batman. A YouTube compilation of scenes from the 1960s children's television series show amongst the gadgets a number that demonstrate detectors, computer function and wireless capabilities. Like the prototype UB under development, teaching resources such as this will go through tuning, additions, subtractions, or just become a footnote that's stimulated a much better idea. This can be seen as a prototype. This lesson. Thus, this lesson. Further, teachers can read it at a schematic level, much like a circuit diagram. Okay, so they can work out, they can think through basically what's going to work with the kids, you know, as a lesson plan. That's why they need it. Okay, a small number of students will be interested in the steps to turn an analog sensor into a digital sensor, which is sort of like, actually, I'm using a teaching technique with the teachers, you know, saying, oh, I have a friend who's interested in this, and this is what said. Oh, it releases people from the contract of understanding. Something happens, so they can go and listen into it. They're listening in, the eavesdropping. Something happens. An environmental factor changes an electrical property of a device or component. Voltage changes. Electricity is provided to create a potential difference. Signal volts on an output signal wire. Signal snapshot. The signal is put into a circuit that mirrors the signal when set to sample. Obviously, inverted commas. But freeze is when set to hold, inverted commas again. It's called a sample and hold, and provides a steady snapshot of a signal for the rest of the A to for the A to D to work on, for the other components, other parts. There too, it's equivalent to think of a number, now remember it, and we will guess it. Digital approximation, guess it. So digital approximator. Another circuit goes to work guessing the SH level with a succession of more precise approximations. The component that stores the evolving estimate is called the Successive Approximation Register, or SAR. Registers in the electronics mean memory that can be written during a writing phase and later read. Think of a register as a piece of paper on which key information is written, like a shopping list or homework. We'll talk through the key steps using the compiling of a shopping list as an example. Writing is like going through your cupboards at home and jotting down what's needed. Reading the list is done when the shop assistant asks, "What would you like?" And finally erasing or rubbing out the list so you can write it again. In the SAR, the writing is recorded in switches that are toggled on and off. Beginning with the erase step or set off, the SAR goes through the rapid cycle of internal writing to each switch in succession. On each occasion, all switches are read at once and converted to a voltage level represented by the guess. This creation of an analog signal from a digital instruction performed by a group of electronic components called an analog, a digital to analog converter, DAC. Okay, is that a good sense? This creation of called the sense. Comparing the DAC with the SAH tells the SAR to keep the latest edition if it hasn't overshot the target voltage of the SH from the SH. This process runs until the SAR is finished and changes from approximating busy state to a from an approximation again inverted commas to a completed state. Okay. Reporting approximation. The SAR receives a write to output command and reads its register. One register setting the data line high. It's register. This is really bad English. The SAR receives a write to output command and reads the register, one register setting the data line high or low, but typically a millionth, 5 billionth of a second, and then the next until, one register setting at a time. I think at a time there. I think I can do a bit. It's going to take, people are going to really rip through this. Then the next until all registers are sent out in a 1 or 0 pulse train. For everything to be done, the synchronism in synchronism, the A to D requires a clock signal. Reset. The SAR is erased and signal sampled. Additional deeper detail describes the comparator as a high gain voltage different amplifier that amplifies negative input difference to a large negative value but clipped to 0.5 volts. Similarly, a positive difference is amplified to a large positive value but clipped by the electronics to supply level potential difference. Yeah, it's just so hard. Okay, coming to the end here. In 1987, I was helping in a clean out of the Adelaide University Physics Laboratories. Valve-based analog digital converter built in the early 1970s was no longer useful. It was the size of a travel suitcase. Having had this experience gives a nowadays rare perspective on units 100,000 times smaller than or near or even smaller. Near or even inside sensors. Rather than throwing out this experience, it may be one day possible for students to go on a virtual reality tour of the inside of an ADC. The key teaching points here is that the signal you're interested in can be mixed with the signal you're interested in can be mixed with noise that grow and noise and grows weaker over distances and obstacles. You can even have echoes from such things as seemingly insignificant as a fingerprint on a plug. Small signal levels over any distance require boosting, termed preamplification, for being sent. Signals take many snapshots at sufficient rates. Digital A to Ds take many snapshots at sufficient rates to make a movie. And these snapshots spell out SNAPSHOT, one letter or 0 or 1 bit at a time. Unlike reading analog signals, there's only a binary decision to be made, is it one or not? It is necessarily a more involved process up front, and it takes a sequence of steps, unlike watching Fred Astaire do a step dance. Imagining the time the ADD process took, when in 1987 it was explained to me that it would one day be done so quickly as to digitize human voice. 10,000 hertz at high pitch means 100,000 digitized points per second. I could have been forgiven for saying it would be 100 years before Joe Fictitious would call up his mates on telephone and it would be live digitization. I think you could say two things. One, I was wrong by a factor of 10 in my time estimate. And two, some of the conversations in 1987 were incredibly boring. Okay, so thanks for sitting there. Now, defunct concepts crisis. At each step in the development of the UB, some solutions are uncovered, but also the next suite of design issues emerge. UB has instructive capabilities, but how do you introduce them? How are they taught? The answer developed in this paper is by stepping through introductory lessons alongside describing whilst. I think okay, the UB has instructive capabilities, but how will you teach them? How do you teach them? The answer developed in this paper is stepping through the introductory lessons whilst describing the UB technology. Instructors may be motivated, but they are working from a system that has not I search, let's say, next problem. Problem, colon, next problem. So I pause while I'm writing this, and my writing is it's really, really cold. My writing's horrible. You don't have to worry about that. I do. Next problems. Problems may be motivated, but they are working from a system that has not transitioned to quantum mechanics. Complex issues underlies the propagation of defunct concepts, but they have a simple effect of... Now... disorienting potential instructors. Who do I trust? What I was taught and have taught? Or is there some important steps I'm missing? Should I listen to quantum physicists? No, don't listen to us. We don't know what we're doing. Okay. In the meantime, the path to explaining how silicon works is blocked. In the past, defunct concepts did not cause particular problems, and now they constitute a crisis. Isn't that beautiful? Michael, I think you'll like that one. Now, this is, you can see, I don't know how I'm going to read it. A majority of projects' inputs and outputs are well-defined. There are planning tools such as Gantt charts and critical path programming. Building a house or catering for a social event all have an order of doing things, a deliverable, and a customer that can... at the end of the project pay for an end result at the beginning. pay installments. This is a closed project brief. The utility box has followed an R&D prototyping sequence of concept prototype, research prototype, and finally a production prototype. The aim of each level is to find answers, solutions, strategies, and to get to the next level. Unlike a commodity deliverable, the product is of secondary importance to the knowledge gained, the know-how gained. There is an open brief. The project migrates from being ill-defined to well-defined. The Gantt principles are still beneficial, and the writing of this research paper began in the project openings, waiting for parts to be shipped. Themselves had to wait for evaluation trials. The research paper had itself to evolve as a working document to speak to an interdisciplinary audience spanning technical and non-technical. I've just got to, you can see where I'm moving there, so I'll get back to it, and that's an hour of reading. How's that to get through? Thanks a lot for listening, and it's absolutely slap bang cold here.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.